comfort with a handy chalky against your head. And the main variable there, there's two main variables as I see it, three. One, are you running at the 1 watt level or below, or you're running at 5 watts? Number two, are you using 2 meters or 450? Number three, are you holding it horizontal or vertical? And number four, how long are you transmitting? The way the biohazard specification for the United States works, and is an extremely similar document for the United Kingdom and for Germany and the Scandinavian countries and so on, they all have a 6-minute integration time period. In other words, all of the evidence to date, when I say all, I mean 99 and a fraction percentage of it, says that the effect of RF energy striking human tissue is a conversion of the RF energy into heat. So it's a thermal effect. Lots and lots of people, lots of laboratories, research organizations over the years have looked for the non-thermal effect, and they've never really found it and confirmed it. So since it's thermal, and since you can't boil a pot of water on the stove immediately, it takes a certain amount of time, very similar. You figure out how much energy you received over the last 6-minute period. So you could run full power right at the legal limit, so to speak, and decide to make 3-minute transmissions instead of 6-minute transmissions. And as far as the way the specification works, you would be getting half the exposure. Or 1-minute transmissions would be 1/6 the exposure. That's the way it works. So the human eye, which is the most delicate organ as far as RF energy is concerned, you could say your eye has a 6-minute thermal time constant. Your pot of water on the stove is even longer than that. But it allows you to see the principle. So making brief transmissions, just like you and I do, Mel, you and I, when we get a microphone in front of us, we usually talk for a very short period of time. Hello, goodbye, and that's a joke. There's four ways you can keep it safe. And the fifth way, of course, is to use a speaker mic or Bluetooth. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, well, just want to know what's rolling. Speaker mic, keep your hands free mostly. I have the radio hanging on my belt, and I pull the antenna up, put it horizontal or vertical because I have that pivot on the antenna. And pleasure that I have the speaker mic hanging on my lapel. First of all, thanks so that you can understand the person very well because, you know, the earphone, or I should say the speaker, is close to the ear. And I find that it's been excellent over the years. I've owned several handy talkies and always got the speaker mic with them, and can't imagine, you know, why anybody would have any problems with it. So that's the words on that. Let's see. Oh, yeah. I was going to tell you about what happened that we got to the ham bench today. I wondered, did you go, Dick, over?
I had great intentions of going and didn't make it for a business reason. And you didn't make it either. So we both missed each other, Mel. Go ahead.
Did somebody want to ask something?
That extra sound you heard was me. I unplugged something at the wrong time.
Okay, sorry. All right. Well, what happened is, as they say, I was a little under the weather today. That's a mild, mild word of wisdom that I should have got myself into this predicament. I was all planned. I was up this morning and everything, and I felt kind of lousy. In fact, I think I was running a little fever, I was coughing a little bit, sneezing. I said, here comes that cold. And it's my basically my own fault because the last couple of days I got drenched. Twice I got let myself get into a predicament. Friday, I parked the car a bit of a distance from where I had to go. And because it was very restricted parking in the area where I had to get to. And so I have to park at least 5 blocks away, I'd say. I don't mind walking, and I walked, and just as I'm getting to my destination, I said, oh, what did I leave? Purposely took my umbrella, put it in the car right next to me, and of course, left the car without it. Well, make a long story short, on the way back to the car, about 2 hours later, it came down. And I was, I could say, out in the middle of nowhere, so I tried to make a run for it, but by the time I got to the car, that literally was drenched from head to toe, including flooded shoes. So, what did I do? I wind up doing almost the same thing the next day on Saturday. So, I had the chills and everything. Oh boy, did I really, I got to that, it was a deluge the way it came down. So, I'm still suffering the after effects of it. So that's why I could not get to the ham fest. I don't think I was focusing too well this morning. Dick, go ahead.
Okay. Of the people who did attend the ham fest today, if anyone would like to tell us what it was like, how many vendors, how many had any buyers. I know that Andy ran his a tune-up clinic. The weather was good. Were there some goodies there? Anyone want to tell us what the ham fest was like? Give us your call. That is right now. K2RIW on the TechNet.
W2PNJ.
W2PNJ, Bob. Is there anyone else? Okay, Bob, go ahead and tell us what you saw.
What I saw was a tremendous outpouring of Limar Club spirit. We were told to be there at 7 o'clock this morning to help set up. I got there about 10 of 7. It looked like the guys were there from 6 o'clock onward. 50%, more than 50% of the tables were set up at a 10 of 7. Tremendous amount of the friends out there helping the tables and the chairs and setting up. And it was great to see that, such a spirit of cooperation amongst the members of the club.
Sounds good. Roughly how many vendors, how many buyers? Did it run until 1 or 2 in the afternoon, even though it started at 9 in the morning? Back to you, Bob.
The place was packed. I couldn't tell you how many vendors. All the table spaces were occupied. 10:30 at night, I think around 10:30 in the morning was at its peak, and it started to diminish about 12:30. I had to leave early. My wife's not been well, so I had to leave early. But it was, as far as club spirit, that's what really impressed me. It was very good to see that. And I think the club did very well today.
Okay, very glad to hear that. Sounds like it was the one not to miss. Oh, well. And Mel and I missed it. And I guess another one will be coming up in February, if I understand correctly. And the holiday party probably is the first or second week in December. Is that true, if you happen to know, Bob?
I know it's in December, but I'm not sure of the date yet.
Okay. Was there someone else with another comment? Okay. Mel, have you received any mail this week? I say that tongue-in-cheek. Mel, did you receive any mail this week? K2KEY. And by the way, you don't have to do this if you're not feeling well. The choice is yours. K2KEY, K2RIW.
I'm okay, Dick. K2KEY. No, it's just not that, I can say, I am not that, you know, at a point where I feel that I have to be, thank God, you know, put to bed. I was up today around after a few hours, a couple cups of hot tea and all, and home brewed chicken soup. But old, I don't want to refer to it as what we call it, the chicken soup. We'll just call it that, it's medication. Works real well. Anyhow, let's see. Well, I try to answer a lot of the emails that we have been getting for the last week, so they were starting to get a little bit piled up here. So even with my Hunt Tech operating the keyboard, I managed to get out as best as possible from answering some of the questions. One of the ones that was still to look at that information on the gap antenna system and maybe you can explain to it. So many people there to see, how does this thing work? I don't know, why is it a departure from most other verticals? See, that's the only one on basically of this type of antenna, situation that they have with rods, shooting rods, no coils, and elevated beams. So did you get a chance possibly to look at it, Dick, and you can answer some questions on it over?
Sorry to say, Mel, I did not. And I know that a couple of weeks now that we've been saying we're going to look at this. I guess if I Google the word gap, I'll find it pretty fast, and maybe at least it'll show me a picture by which we can start making some early assumptions. Back to you, Mel.
Roger. Well, basically, as I said, it's an elevated feed antenna. What is not clear is what are they talking about? Zigzagging a piece of coax cable up in the upper portion of the radiator. What do I mean by a zigzag piece of coax? Is it random? Do you think it's random, or is it or do you believe that it's something that's possibly some kind of matching that is determined by something in the length of the pipe or whatever? Do you have any ideas on what it is? Have you ever seen a matching situation like that? Let's put it that way, Dick. Over.
Okay. When it comes to resonating an antenna, and a very good sentence to remember with reference to antennas is you resonate first, radiate second. You get very poor radiation if the antenna system is not resonated. Now, system means the thing you call antenna, the feed line, the antenna tuner, and the final stage of the transmitter. That combination will come into resonance. Radiation is very difficult. Everyone believes that, hey, the antenna was 72 ohms. If I was feeding it with 72 ohm twin lead, for instance, just as an example, you would assume the signal would flow down the transmission line once and go into the antenna. That part is true. If you've got a low standing wave ratio and the antenna is resonant, if the dipole is 72 ohm, the energy will flow down the transmission line once, go into the antenna. The next assumption people make is that the signal flows down the antenna and just jumps into space. The antenna itself runs at an extremely high standing wave ratio. Even a perfectly resonant full-length dipole, that energy bounces back and forth roughly 30 times before it gets radiated into space. What we call resonance of the antenna is to make sure that all of those bounces stay in step. So there are certain electrical lengths that make that happen. If for whatever reason you are forced to make the antenna smaller than the normal physical size, if it's a dipole half-wave long, if it's a ground plane or monopole quarter-wave long, but the normal resonant size, if you are forced for physical reasons or economic reasons to use a shorter length, you can still reestablish electrical resonance by using top hat capacitors, loading coils at the bottom, or zigzagging the antenna. And the zigzagging can literally be making right angle turns or 30 degree turns multiple times. It can be spiraling the antenna. Anything that adds length to the wire electronically, and maybe not physically, will bring the resonant frequency of the antenna down to a lower frequency. So you can establish the length straight out. That's the most desirable. You can establish the length in various bent and rolled up combinations, like, for instance, the helical antenna. So most of the time, when somebody is zigzagging or helical loading of an antenna, he is making it work at a lower frequency than the physical dimensions of the antenna would dictate. There's another couple of words I was going to add to that. You would think that the helical portion would not radiate very well. It radiates extremely well. People think that a dipole has to be out straight in order to perform well, because that's the way it's photographed in the book. So the diagrams in the books show it that way. The dipole itself can have a great big bend in the center, like an inverted V. Or it can be a real V, because you've got the weight of the coax in the middle, and you didn't pull it tight on the end. You can have a ridiculous amount of bend to the dipole, and you have very little change in performance. The dipole itself can become extremely short, like a tenth of a wavelength long instead of a half wavelength long. And as long as you're smart enough to do a good job of impedance matching it with an antenna tuner, and the antenna tuner, if your feed line loss is low enough, the antenna tuner can be in the shack. It doesn't have to be at the antenna. Once you reestablish resonance, a dipole that is one quarter or one eighth the normal size, you would think would have one quarter or one eighth the gain. Absolutely not. In the process of reestablishing the resonance, the voltage on the dipole builds up to much higher voltages, and 89% of the gain comes back, something like that. You get four-tenths of a dB of loss as you make a dipole go from full length down to infinitesimal length. And that's out of John Krause's book, Antennas, a very respected book, and portions of that get repeated in the Antenna Engineering Handbook. So the infinitesimal dipole has almost the exact same pattern as a full dipole, and only lose 4/10 of a dB of gain. If you start off with 2.14 dB gain over isotropic, that's what a normal dipole does, an infinitesimal dipole is 1.76 dB over isotropic. Opposite is common sense. That's the magic of resonance. If you didn't resonate it, wow, it picks up a much, much smaller signal. However, if you're operating a receiver, that may be good enough. New engineers are always amazed about the fact that you have to be very careful with properly impedance matching and resonating a transmitting antenna, because the transmitter is pretty persnickety. You put a transmitter into a poorly matched antenna, and there's a chance you're going to damage the transmitter, and there's a chance that people won't hear you very well. By comparison, a receiver is extremely forgiving. A full dipole on 80 meters is 131 feet long. You could take your 80-meter receiver, connect a clip lead that's a couple of feet long to the center conductor of the connector on the back panel of the receiver, and you will hear a beautiful 80-meter signal. You won't get as much S-meter deflection, but you'll hear them very well. At first, you'll say, how in the world can this happen? Well, on 80 meters, the amount of noise that Mother Nature makes is 30 or 40 dB above threshold of the receiver. So when you make an antenna that's super short, that's got an extremely high vis-wire, and you're using it as a receiving antenna, just a random length of wire, you'll receive 20 decibels less noise of the band and 20 less decibels of signal on the band from other amateurs. The signal-to-noise ratio stays the same. As long as your receiver's got enough sensitivity, as long as you're on a low enough band, below 10 meters, a very small antenna for receiving can work very well. That's part of what Mel has experienced, although Mel is getting almost full gain because he is resonating his small loop antenna. Once you resonate it, it comes back to full size electronically, even though your eye doesn't see it. Those electrons get fooled as long as the antenna resonates. That piece of wire of Con Ed going between the telephone poles that's parallel to your dipole out in front of your house is not resonant. Therefore, the signal that flows from that direction over to your antenna has almost no impact from the Con Ed wiring. Only if you were very unlucky and that wire happened to be a multiple or resonant length, it would make a serious blockage. So when you resonate something, its effective capture area goes up, its gain goes up tremendously. But a receiver doesn't always need that. So zigzagging is usually a way of moving the frequency down lower for that length of material, physical length. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Well, when I say zigzag, they're zigzagging the coax. That's what I didn't quite understand. They got the coax going up the center of the pipe, and the top section, oh, I don't know how many feet it is, maybe about 15 feet of it or so, the pipe, they have a piece of coax in there that's zigzagging in the pipe. I was wondering how does that work, that the coax in the pipe zigzagging, is that part of the matching system or part of the making the top a radiator, or exactly what do you Have you ever experienced anything like the elevated speed antenna takeover?
Welcome to the W2.
Okay, I got some further guesses on this one, Mel. Depending on what characteristic impedance you're using for the coax cable that's feeding an antenna, there are certain magic lengths that will help. Also, quite often an antenna that's really tuned higher or lower than the frequency you want to use it at can be corrected by using a quarter wave or I won't say quarter wave, a shorted or an open circuited stub. So if they're using stubs for impedance matching, and because you want to hide the stub inside of the structure in order to be a convenient place to place it, and because the stub is a little bit on the long side compared to the length of the structure inside where you can hide it, zigzagging it would allow the stub itself, which is a piece of coax cable, to have the same length, even though electrical length, even though physically you don't have enough pipe to put it in. That's one possibility. Another possibility is that something that looks like a coax stub is being used as a capacitive loading device, a distributed capacitive loading device, where the outer shield of the coax acting as a kind of transmission line to the pipe itself. There's a lot of ways you can go. You study some of these antennas, and some of them, you almost have to take an X-ray to find out what all is going on. Inside the pipe, you got various things happening. We all know what coax cable looks like. There's a material called twinax, where you have twin lead inside of a coax outer braid. There's also triaxial cable, and I have on one occasion seen quadraxial cable. And what's really crazy is that the real center conductor looks at the next layer of outer coax, outer shield to it, and it establishes a certain impedance there and sends a signal down it. The next layer of coax, the outer shield, going to the one above it that's larger in diameter, that's another piece of coax. And the signal flowing between those two is thoroughly separate and independent from the one that's flowing down the real center conductor. So you could have one piece of line that looks like an ordinary piece of coax cable because it has multiple diameters of things inside of it. It could have multiple signals flowing in various directions at various frequencies down the inner layers of all this thing. So some of these tricks are maybe being used by the gap antenna. And until we figure out how it's all electrically connected, we're not going to know. Right now, you and I are speculating. If I can go out and get some more information and spend the time, sounds to me like this antenna really should be reverse engineered. Sounds to me like quite a bit of smarts has been put into it. I'm getting the impression that people have bought it, used it, they're happy with it, and all these extra little doodads, I think, are all doing something. And as we reverse engineer it and find out how, I think some of these concepts can be applied to other antennas that we already have or are about to build. There's always something to be learned. K2KEY, K2RIW.
This is K2KEY. Y'all, that's why it's tutored a little further. It seems to be a little bit of a departure from what we're normally, you know, involved with in antennas vertical. And, in fact, the method that they use for tuning, you know, they have these rods sitting around the antenna, these lengths of rods, and I believe they're only electrically connected at up to either the top section or the bottom section, each individual rod. And the antennas are covering quite a number of bands. They have one that goes from, I believe, 80 through 6 meters. And I was wondering, how the heck do they, how are you achieving this match on all these bands with just these pieces of rod outside hanging, you know, alongside the pipe, Vic? I didn't quite understand it. The antenna was invented in England, according to the article that was in, I believe, in QST. And there was another guy in, I think, in Canada, UFC, I believe, who's written a number of articles on elevated feet, shunt feet, towers and things of that sort. And he made some comments on it, but I was quite interested to figure out how this thing actually works. But from what I could see of one of them that we put together, a friend of mine has one down the block that is at the top of the pipe. They had a capacitor that was connected. The point that the capacitor is right at the top of the pipe is a like about, I think it was about 2,300 PF. It's like one of these old barrel capacitors. That one portion of it was, one side of the capacitor was bolted to the pipe itself, and the other one went to a lug that they had up there that supposedly comes from that coax. So I didn't quite understand how to do the matching or anything, or how these rods sitting alongside of it through the individual bands. So to me, it was quite fascinating to have seen one of these antennas, but no, didn't think too much of it at the time. But got a number of inquiries of how do you believe this works, take over.
Yeah, I went to the Gap products. I'm looking at what I think is called the Gap Titan. I see the fact that it's got these rods coming down the sides. It looks like there's one rod to the north, one rod to the south, one rod to the east, one rod to the west. The picture I'm looking at seems to show two equal rods east and west, whereas the two rods north and south are both a little bit longer and of slightly different lengths. Interesting looking structure. And then there's a what looks like a radiator coming above that with a rod alongside of it. Almost looks like a gamma matching setup. So far, is that the picture that I should be looking at, Mel? And I see that this thing is mounted on the roof of a house with guy wires going to the middle of the antenna. Let's make sure I've got the right antenna first. K2KEY, K2RYW.
Yeah, Roger. This is called the Titan DX. Yeah, that's the one. I knocked myself off the air for a minute. That antenna is the one I'm thinking of. Now, if you notice this sort of loop on the bottom, that's supposedly the counterpoise, just like a like a square loop or something on the bottom, and it has these rods, like I say, hanging there, and the pipe, the upper pipe, and how they achieve the match and on all these bands, and I don't really quite understand how it works, Dick. I could say it was reviewed in one of the QSTs, but I don't think they understood either, because they said they're not quite sure if it finally, that was the final word, not quite sure how this thing actually works. I was amazed to read, that, Dick, over.
Okay, one of the photographs I'm looking at where the thing is mounted near the ground, the loop at the bottom I see is under the four, what I'm going to call ground plane radials that are elevated. They look to me like they're 5 feet in the air, the four ground plane radials. And I see a loop of wire below that, which looks like a so-called poor man's ballon, where you take a few turns of the feeding coax cable and loop it back on itself and tape it together. Is that the loop you're talking about, Mel? Go ahead.
Yeah, the loop on the bottom is four rods that go up the main pipe on the bottom. And there's like a wire stretched around it, around the outer periphery with insulated. That's supposed to be, I believe, the counterpoise take over.
Yeah, now that you told me what to look for, I do see the wire going to the tips of the four ground plane radios. Also, the coax cable, the feed line, has another loop. That's a ballon. But the wire that goes between the around the perimeter of the four ground plane radials, I think, is a lower capacitor-like device. It's a super large capacitor top hat, perhaps, to be at the bottom. So that is, in my opinion, a broadband counterpoise. The rod above it, I'm not quite sure yet how it's fed. Oh, I see the coax cable going up the center of that pipe, and then I think it goes to the top of the pipe where it feeds a radiator above that that has these four rods hanging down the bottom. Crafty looking antenna. I guess you're saying if I dig a little bit deeper, I'm going to find lots and lots of pictures here of the thing in operation. And it's a tilt-over mechanism and whatever. Fancy looking antenna. to your knowledge, Mel, I think you said you've already constructed one in your area. Is the person using it fairly happy with it? Would you call this a popular antenna? And would you say that most of the purchases are happy campers? Back to you, Mel.
Well, this is K2KY. The person that's not on the air too much. But when he was using it, he said he's very happy. He specified when you purchased the antenna. He purchased it because basically he wanted it for the CW. He specified whether he wanted the CW portion of the band or if you want the phone portion. You cannot alter it or you can't intermix it. And I gave him a hand putting it together. And they recommend that you dry it because, you know, the height doesn't whip around up there with all those rods hanging there. It is a little bit on the top-heavy side. Not very heavy. And, you know, it's just, I guess it just starts to whip around with that amount of wind resistance that it will develop just because of those rods and the sort of top, more mass at the top. It went together fairly easy. There's nothing complicated. The rods are held off the main pipe up there with a piece of PVC, and they're connected with some length of just stranded wire, and to the main pipe with lugs and all. And the antenna came basically assembled to the point where the wire, that coax cable that supposedly zigzag up to the main section on the top, was already there. The only thing we had to do was connect, put that capacitor on the top, and then put a plug, you know, to plug up the top, you know, a cover, so the water don't get in there. And the bottom pipe just slipped over. You just slip it over on the gap portion and secure it. And the whole thing went together within an hour, Dick. Go ahead.
I see there's another antenna here called the Super C, but we're not talking about that one. There's also mono gaps, which I think are tuned to one band at a time. And I think when you Google the word gap, you also get a number of other things you can click on here. Revolutionary technology. Looks to me like it's got a lot of possibility here, Mel, as I see it. The elevated gap. I have a question. Okay, what's your question? Go right ahead.
I moved into a home in Westbury that they didn't let anybody put an antenna up. Now, they came along, they put the holes and I put the coax cable. Beneath the ground. Two, you won't believe it. Now you've got that is tied to the part of the drain pipe, and that's what I'm using. So when you talk all these things, I wonder sometimes what the hell is happening.
Sorry about that. Transmitted the wrong way. I was listening to you on the input. Your audio, sir, is so loud that periodically you break out of the computer, the repeater, and I had to listen to you on the input to get the whole conversation. I wish I could remember the author's name. I own a book where an author tells you all kinds of ways of making hidden antennas, where you can use the gutters, the drain pipe, the house gutters, a flagpole out front, the Venetian blinds, all kinds of ways you can make an antenna. Even if you're setting up a law enforcement vehicle, an ordinary automobile, every piece of sheet metal that does or doesn't join the car can be made into an antenna. There are law enforcement vehicles that use the side view mirror as an antenna. There are cars that use the rear speaker as a kind of an antenna, the one that looks up through the rear window. the gap between the fender and the body of the car can be made into an antenna. The bumper can be made into an antenna. So there's all kinds of ways you could make a plain closed car with antennas on board. VHF-wise, it's easy. HF-wise, it becomes hard. But when it comes to a private home, if there's a restriction that you're not allowed to have antennas, if you're crafty enough, there's lots of ways you can make an antenna that will not show. So there are books on this particular subject, and just because it doesn't look like a conventional antenna we're all used to, doesn't mean it's not going to work well. The most extreme example I can think of, which was a Limark member 20, 25 years ago named Herbie, don't remember Herbie's last name, but he invented something called the Herbie Snake Antenna. He was getting so frustrated because his zoning board of his town wouldn't allow him to put anything in the air. He made an antenna that lays flat on the ground. He started with pieces of RG8 coax cable and cut it up in certain ways and fed it in certain ways, and a piece of coax cable laying flat on his lawn was his 20-meter antenna. We ran on-the-air tests with it and compared it to people in his town that were running a real 20-meter dipole in the air. Without a doubt, Herbie's antenna was lower in volume. It wasn't radiating as well, but he was making two-thirds with an antenna that laid flat on the ground. So what really is an antenna? That's what I think you were about to ask us. What really is required for a minimum antenna? And the answer is not simple. You open up the really good books, like the Antenna Engineering Era book, and you'll find out there are, if you count them, depending on how you count, and whether or not you consider this antenna really different from that antenna, depending on how you count, you can easily come up with thousands of antennas, thousands of types of antennas. And so there's lots of ways of doing it. And it doesn't have to be out straight, up high, made out of a piece of a 14-gauge wire, as a dipole, for instance. It can be made out of 38-gauge wire. It can be using buttons as an insulator. It can be part of a flagpole. It can be hidden in all kinds of things. So there's lots of ways of building an antenna. Just because you're a landlord, you're a zoning board, your mother, your father, your wife, whatever, won't allow it. With a little bit of compromise, there are ways of doing it. Don't give up. It's a good hobby. You'll find a way. Just take a look at what Motorola and Nokia and everyone else has done when it comes to cell phones. I mean, cell phones began as what you and I would call the bag phone, something that was so heavy you slung it over your shoulder, had a great big antenna sticking out of it, weighed 10 or 15 pounds, and it sort of worked. And what do you have today? Something that's considerably smaller than a pack of cigarettes. It doesn't have any obvious antenna. The antenna used to be close to the earphone, to the part that speaks to your ear. Now the antenna is down near the microphone at the bottom of the radio, hidden inside. You take the radio apart, a Motorola Razr, for instance, and you'll find the antenna inside. Looks like a bent-up, gold-plated piece of a paperclip. That is the antenna. And it works on multiple frequencies. The phone works on the 880 meg band. It works on, that's for transmitting, for receiving. It works on the 843 meg band for transmitting, and 820 meg region for transmitting, and 880 meg region for receiving the handpiece. There's always 45 meg separation between the transmit and receive frequency. The cell phone also works on the 1800, 1900 frequency region. All of that on this bent-up, gold-plated, paperclip-like thing hidden inside of the radio, down at the bottom, near the microphone. So, if you're crafty enough, any piece of metal bent up in almost any shape can be made into an antenna. If you resonate it at the frequency you're looking at, the antenna can be an extremely small fraction of a wavelength and perform very well. So the gutters, the drain pipe, the flagpole, the fence, the screening on the window, crafty amateurs have made antennas out of every one of them. If you have any further questions, KQLIW on the TechNet.
10-2 QMU question.
QMU recognized. The original questioner, are you still there? Okay, Mr. QMU, start off with your name, sir. and then your question or comment.
This is Bill, N2QMU. I have a question about balance, and what I want to do is use a 300-ohm feed line so that I don't have to drill a hole through the wall. I could just slam the window on it and have an east balance at the radio and at the antenna.
Without a doubt. Almost every radio you're likely to buy, Bill, has 50 ohms as the recommended output load for the radio, output impedance, you could call it. And the vast majority of the antennas you buy in the United States will be 50-ohm antennas. Some of the antennas you can buy in Europe are 70-ohm. And that's a pretty long distance from 300. 300-ohm twin lead is a nice kind of transmission line. And it comes for a transmitting size, a great big heavy 300-ohm twin lead, as well as the pretty light stuff that used to be used for television reception. However, twin lead, launching the signal into the twin lead in the shack requires a kind of a balancing structure, and in theory you need another balancing structure up in the air at the antenna to go from twin lead back to the 50-ohm coax to feed the antenna. That's a little bit of a pain. I would rather see you consider a very small diameter piece of coax to go through a very small hole in the wall or go through a panel that you generate. What some guys have done is they make a wooden or fiberboard panel that goes under the window. In other words, you raise the sash of the window so that it's an opening, make this device that is, let me pick a number, an inch high and as wide as the window, and then you close the window on it. You build one for the storm window, you wouldn't build one for the regular window, and then you could have coax fittings on it to feed the signal out the window, and yet the window is essentially closed, and you're getting the same weatherproofing, so to speak. Even if you have a large diameter coax going to your antenna, there's nothing stopping you from a very short diameter, a short piece of small diameter coax that goes through the window device that I just described, through a small hole in the wall, and so on. Loss of coax is a function of two things, its diameter and its length. If 99% of your transmission line is the large diameter, low-loss coax, and a couple of inches or a foot of it is some other kind of material that easily fits through your particular hole in the wall, so to speak, it doesn't mean you're going to get a whole lot of loss just because you've interrupted with that small little piece. People think individual connectors have loss. They do not. People think that small diameter coax has a lot of loss. It only does if you've got a lot of length of it. Anything wrong with a very small diameter coax is maybe it's not rated for a full kilowatt when you transmit. So there's very crafty ways you can get your feed line from inside the house to outside the house. By way of twin lead, yes, the twin lead can be clamped down, but you can slam a window on it. And if the window is made out of wood, pretty good. If the window is made out of aluminum, slamming the aluminum window down on twin lead is not so good. In theory, you need some kind of an impedance matching device to take care of the fact that where the metal window is pressed up against the twin lead, in that vicinity, it is not 300-ohm twin lead. Where the metal window is pressed up against it, assuming you don't cut through the insulation, in that vicinity, maybe it is a 41-ohm twin lead, if you know what I mean. And if the window is very short in thickness, in wavelength, probably you can ignore that. However, when you transmit through it, the voltage in that area could possibly arc through the insulation of the twin lead over to the aluminum window. It's not going to hurt the window, but if it arcs through, your transmitter is not going to be very happy, and you're not going to radiate a very clean signal. So I'm not saying don't use the twin lead under the window as a method of getting the signal inside. I'm saying do consider some of the other techniques before you completely commit to that one. In my particular case, I took a dryer vent that's intended to bring the tubing coming out of a clothes dryer and intended to bring it through the wall. I installed that through the wall. On the outside of the house, it's an attractive-looking device. It looks like it's part of the house, except that mine has a whole bunch of coax cables coming out of it. And the nice thing about that is I can always easily add other coax cables. Just pull out the piece of foam that fills up the empty space, add as many pieces of coax as I want, and stuff the foam back in there. And to me, that's a very convenient way of getting a lot of cables from inside the house to outside the house. We amateurs rarely are happy with one single antenna, Bill. the day will come when you're going to want 2, 3, 4, 5 antennas, and it's kind of nice to be able to feed them with the 4 or 5 individual pieces of coax cable. And you can transmit on one and receive on the other and use switching networks and whatever and have a grand old time. So do think of the future where the day will come when just one piece of transmission line going from inside the house to outside may not be enough. So don't give up. There's lots of ways of doing it. Now back to you, Bill. N2QMU, K2RIW in the Tech Net. My name is...
The commenting N2EO.
Rich recognized, but Bill first. Go ahead, Bill.
That all sounds good. Thank you very much. I guess you answered all my questions and more.
Yeah, I didn't tell you how to make a balun for the 300 ohm twin lead. And if you take at your operating frequency a piece of coax cable that is with the velocity factor half wavelength long, you loop it back on itself so it's a great big U-shaped object. And both the input end and the output end, you connect the shields together, bring a third piece of coax to it, and connect the shields together. So you got three pieces of coax coming together. One's in the U-shape, and one's the coax coming out of the transmitter. All three shields get connected together. The center conductor of the coax coming from the transmitter connects to one of the center conductors of the U-shaped piece. Now, the two center conductors of the U-shaped piece go directly to the 300 ohm twin lead. That U-shaped object is called a half-wave coax balun. It has a 4-to-1 ratio to it. You build it out of 50 ohm coax and start over the piece of 50 ohm coax. It brings your impedance up to 200 in a balanced manner. And 200 ohms feeding 300 ohm twin lead is only a 1.5 standing wave ratio. Worst case, if you don't use some other method of even correcting for that, and that's a 2/10 of a dB of insertion loss. Nothing. Don't worry about it. So, in theory, if you built one of those at the transmitting end and install another one of those backwards at the receiving end, where the antenna is, so to speak, that's one way of feeding 300 ohm twin lead, half wave coax balun. To some people, that's the best way of doing it. In fact, the driven element on many a T-matched dipole as part of a Yagi antenna uses that technique. The RIW-19 Yagi for 432 megacycles use that technique for feeding the driven element of the dipole driven element of that Yagi. Let's see what Rich has to say. N2EO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, first off, will he run 350 ohm line? It is not necessary to use a balun between the twin lead and the antenna. Technically, there's a mismatch, but the open wire line is so low loss, it just doesn't matter. Where he wants to match it to go into coax into the house, I recommend one of the balluns by DX Engineering. DX Engineering, you can look them up on the internet. They've got two balluns made to work with a tuner. Their balluns are very high power, but I'm not recommending it for that reason. I'm recommending it because they're watertight, they're waterproof, and they're high quality. They got one for $119, wound with number 10 Teflon wire. It'll take up to 5 kilowatts, and believe it or not, he'll have a 10 kW, but he doesn't need that. As far as bringing it into the house, the coax, what I use here is a 6-inch, 2-inch diameter PVC plumbing pipe nipple. I drilled a hole in the house with the basement in the sill plate and inserted a plumbing nipple and corked around the outside. RIW-M2EL.
Okay, so DX Engineering has some nice products that help. And it sounded like he wanted to use 300 ohm twin lead because he wanted to clamp the window back down on it. to do that with 450 ohm open wire line or 600 ohm open wire line is a little more difficult, but doable. And so, as you can tell, Rich's suggestion is that if you're using open wire line made out of large enough diameter copper with a great enough spacing, those kinds of transmission lines are so extremely low in insertion loss that even though the signal will have a very high standing wave ratio because you haven't created a good impedance match. In other words, a 50 ohm antenna hanging on 450 ohm line in theory is a, I think it's an 8-to-1 standing wave ratio, which would be pretty darn high, and you think you're going to get a lot of loss. With the right kind of an antenna tuner in the house, the transmitter will be happy. The signal will be bouncing back and forth a few times on the open wire line, but those extra bounces create a little bit more loss. But if the wire starts off with such a low loss to begin with, you can ignore that. That's what he's doing. So he hasn't even bothered to re-impedance match the open wire line back down to 50 ohms or 70 ohms at his antenna at the top of the tower, so to speak. So there's lots of ways of doing it. Trying to remember, is there a good book? Well, the ARRL antenna book will give you a lot of hints, Bill. I do recommend you consult that one. Get yourself a copy of it. Lots of good information in there on many, many subjects. I think there's about 15 or 18 chapters, some of them devoted to transmission lines, some of them devoted to balance, all of them devoted to antennas, antenna patterns, what happens when you make the wire extra long for a long wire antenna, and so on. Awful lot of good information there with a disc in the back that gives you even more information and the computer programs to model many of these situations. So for a while I used one of those plates that I mentioned where the window slammed back down on the plate. I did it as a temporary structure. I built it out of fiberboard, and that temporary structure I used it for a number of years. The rain falling onto it eventually made it a little bit ratty looking. Had I been smart enough to make it out of a more weatherproof material like plexiglass or micarta or bakelite, then it wouldn't have showed weather characteristics. Also, you can make a multiple sandwich of it so it acts like storm window and even gives you a better weather insulation as far as temperature difference is concerned. So that's one way of bringing lots of cables from inside the house to outside the house without making any permanent changes to the house. If, for instance, you're living in a rental apartment, or if you're living in a house that you're going to sell sometime soon, you may be reluctant to drill a hole in the wall and install the 2-inch diameter PVC pipe that Rich installed, or to install the approximately 2-inch diameter dryer vent pipe that I installed. You might not want to do that, but it is a good way to go. On top of that, the coax cable doesn't have to come out of the most desirable location. Almost every house has air-breathing vents in the eaves of the roof. A surprising number of amateurs have brought the coax cable out between those louvers of that air vent. Some amateurs will drill a hole through the cinder block wall or the concrete of the basement. And so the wire, the coax cable, for instance, is exiting at ground level and maybe even an inch below ground level so that nobody can see it. So there are ways you can bring wire from inside the house to outside the house that you cannot see. So I do recommend you consider some of these. If you got any further questions, I'm going to turn it back to you, Bill. N2QMU, K2RIW in the TechNet.
WS2N, question.
I have visitors, so I'll have to sign off shortly. One thing that crossed my mind, I do have the ARRL antenna book, and I was interested in toroids, but it's mysterious about the different types of ferrite.
Okay, when you finish with your company and come back, we'll delve into that subject, Bill. Paul, with your question, go ahead.
I like your sash idea, Dick. Did you drill through this fiberboard, in other words, just one solid piece from one end to the other and then drill through it, and now you put your coax through? I think that's a good way to go. Or did you just
leave a space for the coax to go through. Just thinking about this, drilling through sounds like a, you know, a good way to go. You could really make a tight seal.
Yeah, the way I did it, Paul, is that I installed female-to-female connectors into the fiberboard. So I had a number of these female-to-female connectors where the coax from the transmitter connected to the connector on the sash board, I'm going to call it, and then the coax outside the house are reconnected. That's one way of doing it. Another way would be to drill slots into it, and the coax cable lays in the slot, and then the right kind of rubbery material could be put around the slot to seal it, and the window slam back down on it. That's one approach. Another approach is to drill a hole through and put the coax through the hole before you put the connector on the end of the coax. That's a third way you can do it. The people who build that sash feed-through device with female-to-female connectors, and they come in both UHF and Type N, and some of them are very long lengths to them, the people who do that have one great big advantage when it comes to a lightning storm coming along. They've got a convenient place in which they can unscrew the coax and disconnect the rigs from the antennas. So there's an advantage with that one. So the sash board, as I'm going to call it, I'm trying to remember, I think I had something like 6 or 7 total feed lines going through mine. And as I said, the biggest mistake I made is it was a quickie temporary job, and I made it out of some kind of fiberboard, and various very heavy rains did soak into that fiberboard and made it kind of ratty looking. And I should have made it out of, as I said, more permanent materials like plexiglass, lucite, lexite, polycarbonate. There's a whole lot of kinds of plastic, both clear and various colors that you can build it out of. Go to a place that used to be called Lerner Plastics on Allen Boulevard in Farmingdale, and just go through their scrap bins, and boy, there's all kinds of chunks of plastic that'll give you some ideas. So that one, the holes in the wall we've already discussed, and the air vents that are on the roof of almost every house are some convenient places to bring feed lines out of. What's your favorite way, Paul, of bringing the feed lines from inside to outside of your house? WS2N, H-U-L-I-W.
Okay, well, for now, my shack is in the main floor. I used to be down in the basement, but over the years, I wound up up here. So for now, I drill right through the three-quarter wood, right by the wall, right by the rug. And the lines go straight down in the basement, in front of the basement. And then there's a vent right near the chimney, a metal vent that was installed there when the house was built. And it's really not a functional vent. They put it in when the house was built to vent the basement. It was actually a vent up against the bar joist, the wood bar joist. So I was able to just drill a little hole in the bar joist and go out with all these cables. And then I sealed with duct seal there. And when I put more cables in there, it was just easy to get a can of great stuff. I don't know if you've ever seen that. That's insulating spray. That's terrific. A little hard to dig it out if you want to add another cable, but it's doable. And that's how I get out. And so I'm about a foot off the ground when I get out there. I recommend, what I do is, after I get out, I put a natural bend in the coax, all the wires. I go down and then up, and I put tie wraps out there. This way, when the water migrates down, it's like an external water trap. The water will drip off the bottom of the cable, and it won't migrate and start running, it'll actually start running into the house. You just go out and then go up straight up the run of the chimney or the side of the house. You'll find that water coming down on the outside of the cable and then, coming into the house. So I go out, I go down and back up, and I just use tie wraps and create an inverted loop, like a T-trap for all the cables. Back to you.
Yeah, that's called a drip loop that you installed. Very crafty. So, that's how you did it. Mel, How do you bring all your cables from inside the house to outside the house? Is question number one. Question number two, we should go back to the gap antenna. We didn't finish that one. And eventually, if you feel up to it, we'll...